Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we have an open phone line for an hour in which you can call and ask questions if you'd like to about the Bible or about the Christian faith, about your own Christian life or your spiritual journey. Maybe you're not even a Christian, but you are on a spiritual journey. Or maybe you're not even a Christian or on a spiritual journey. Maybe you don't believe in such things and you've got objections to the whole idea of spiritual things, of Christianity, of God and the Bible. Be glad to talk to you. In any case, feel free to give me a call. We have some lines open right now. That may not be true a little later, so this is a good time to call and jump on to one of these lines, and we'll get you on the program. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And I have a question here that was written in by Doris. She said, and this was some time ago, she said, Steve, my adult daughter, has challenged me with the suggestion that Jesus taught essentially the same things as were taught by other major sages and founders of other religions. For example, that we ought to treat others the same way that we would wish to be treated. I was not sure how to answer her. Can you briefly tell me how Jesus differs from Confucius, Zoroaster, Buddha, and Muhammad? I can't say very much of anything briefly, but I can tell you a little bit. It is true that much of the ethical teaching that Jesus taught has parallels in the ethical teaching of other sages and religious leaders. Jesus taught wonderful ethical teachings, but that was not what he was primarily about. It's been pointed out that if Jesus simply came to give us good ethical teaching, he might as well not have come, because Socrates had already given better ethical teachings than people live up to. What's the point of bringing up more things for people not to live up to? After all, everything Jesus taught, all the ethics, all the behavioral teachings he taught are pretty much found in the law and the prophets and the Psalms in the Old Testament. So, you know, if Jesus had not come, virtually all of his teachings would already and still be with us. Jesus came, of course, to reaffirm those things, but more importantly, to do something that no other religious leader could do. First of all, Jesus was God visiting us in human form. That's something unique to history. No other religious leader or founder ever claimed anything remotely like that. Jesus is the only one who made such a claim, and he made his claim sound reasonable, as reasonable as such a claim can sound. I mean, mental institutions are full of people who claim they're God, or Napoleon, or Jesus, or, you know, Alexander the Great, and they don't sound very credible. Jesus, however, did sound credible because he not only said that he, was one with the Father, and that if you've seen him, you've seen the Father, and the Father was in him, and he was in the Father, and all those things, but he also showed it by doing supernatural feats that no human being could do without supernatural assistance, and by, of course, exhibiting the life of God in his own character and his own behavior as no other man had. Even his enemies said, no man ever spoke like this man. And it's not so much that no one ever spoke the same ethical teachings Jesus did, because many did, including some of the rabbis. But no one ever spoke like Jesus in terms of what he claimed about himself. So at least in terms of what he claimed about himself, he differs from all other teachers. Now, even if his claims are not accepted, even if his claims are viewed as not true, he still is unique in having made them. Not that other people don't make claims of being God, but no other religious leader ever claimed to be God. And therefore, if we name all the great moral teachers and religious teachers, we find that they're all saying in many respects the same things on many points. Not all points, but you're right. Your daughter is right to say that the golden rule is found in the teachings of all the great religions. It's found in, of course, Judaism. It's found in Islam. It's found in Buddhism. It's found in Hinduism. It's found in Zoroastrianism. It's found in all the great religions. And, of course, it's a great ethical teaching, obviously. But if Jesus had only come to teach us the golden rule, he might as well have stayed home in heaven. He didn't have to come down and tell us that. It was already spoken by Moses and others before him. As Paul said, if righteousness came by works of the law, then Christ died for nothing. We have to believe that if Jesus didn't come to do something unique, if God didn't visit this earth one time uniquely for a unique purpose, then he might as well have not come at all. Because if he was only duplicating what other people had done and others after him would do, what's the point of coming down and getting crucified? That seems like a lot of pain, a lot of cost to pay for something that's already been, you know, acquired more easily without it. Jesus came to redeem the world. He came to die for our sins. He came to inaugurate the kingdom of God on this world and to call people to himself to be part of that kingdom. These are things that Jesus did that were unique to him. As I said, he made unique claims about himself that other religious teachers didn't make. But more than that, he did something none of the others did. He predicted his death, and he also predicted his resurrection. And then he suited the action to the word. He actually died in the manner that he said. He said he would be crucified, and he was. He said he would rise from the dead the third day, and he did. And he was seen. And this certainly puts him in a category unlike that of the founder of any other religion. If Jesus' teachings do not necessarily rise very much higher in terms of ethical norms than those of the great ethicists prior to him and after him, it's perhaps only because the great ethical norms that were already known were high enough, and it's simply that people weren't living up to them. We already knew from Socrates and Moses, that people ought to live good lives, selfless lives, put others ahead of themselves and all of that. The problem was not hearing it or knowing it. The problem was doing it, and people don't do it. And not doing it is sin, and it puts us on bad terms with God. So Jesus had to come to do something about the sin problem, to redeem us from sin. No other founder of any religion ever did a single thing about the problem of sin, never redeemed anybody. And that makes Jesus definitely unique among the world's religious founders. All right, that's the brief answer. Let's talk to John from Monterey, California. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I hope you have a great new year. I hope that Narrow Path makes some great strides here in America and elsewhere. I just started the app, Narrow Path app, and it's working really great.
For the iPhone or the Android?
iPhone.
iPhone, yeah, great. Yeah, it's a good app.
Yeah. I went on vacation, and I was like, oh, no, I can't listen to Steve. And then, boom, I called the app. So, hey, great, great. My question today is, I think kind of basic, but that I know that there's the old covenant, and that, well, let's say example would be Judaism is waiting for the old covenant to return, and they want to resurrect Israel, etc. And I understand that's a bit of a fallacy, and in fact, a big fallacy. Yet, the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, seem to be vitally interwoven with the old covenant, and so there's. I don't understand the relationship between bringing the old covenant,
Your phone is breaking up a little bit. Could you summarize what your question is for us?
Well, the churches really stand hard on the ten commandments, but yet aren't they part of the old covenant in a way that?
Yes, the Ten Commandments are part of the Old Covenant. They're not the New Covenant. The Ten Commandments, written on stone, are what Paul refers to as the covenant the covenant of death, written on stones, the covenant of condemnation. And it was passing away, and it did pass away. In 2 Corinthians 3, the Apostle Paul compares the passing away of the law written on stone in the covenant that it was associated with. He compares that with the fading away of the glow on Moses' face when Moses saw God's glory and his own face began to shine, although it was a temporary situation and his face over a period of time did lose that luster, that glow So Paul says, just like Moses' face began to lose that glory, so the covenant that Moses brought loses its glow, its glory also. But it has been replaced with a new covenant. Jesus said to his disciples, I'm making a new covenant with you. This cup is the new covenant in my blood. And the new covenant, therefore, is not the old covenant. In fact, in Jeremiah 31, which is the first place that actually predicts that there will be a new covenant, God says, I'm going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers. So God made a new covenant, and it's not like the old covenant. It has some points of parallel, but it's not the same covenant. Doesn't have the same things in it. Now, let me use an illustration that Paul uses. In Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 4, Paul compares the law with a husband and us with persons married to that husband, with a woman married to a husband. He says that a woman is bound to the law of her husband only while he lives, but when he dies, she's no longer bound to the law of her husband. And if while her husband is living, she marries another man, she is committing adultery. But if she has no living husband, if he's dead, well, then she can remarry without any hint of adultery being there. And he says, so also we are dead to the law by the body of Christ so that we can marry another, even him who rose from the dead, meaning Jesus. So what Paul's saying is, just like marriage is a covenant, that's what it's called, it's a contract or a covenant that two people make when they get married. God entered into a covenant with Israel called the Old Covenant at Mount Sinai. This covenant eventually was discarded because of the unfaithfulness of Israel. And we are said to have died with Christ, and therefore any association with old requirements associated with the Old Covenant would not be applicable, just like when a man dies, his ex-wife, his widow, is not obligated to keep whatever rules he made for the household. He might be a real strict teetotaler, and he might say, listen, I don't want any alcohol in this house ever. Well, then while he's alive and his wife and he are married, then she shouldn't bring any alcohol in the house. But if he dies, she can remarry another person. And the new husband might say, I've got no problem with alcohol in the house. So she can then bring alcohol in the house. She's not under the law of her old husband who died. That first marriage, that first covenant is ended with death. And now there's a new covenant, a new husband. Now, what you'll find in a case like that is, although the old husband, the deceased husband, and the new husband might have some differences with each other, they would have some things in common. For example, they would both expect their wife to be faithful to them. They might both expect the wife to prepare meals and to stay home and raise the children rather than going out and work a job. I mean, there are some things that two different husbands might have in common in terms of what they expect of their wife, but they wouldn't be all things in common. They would be different men with different expectations in some respects. So a woman married to a second husband would have to do some of the same things in her second marriage that she did in her first marriage, because virtually all husbands would expect it of their wives. But she wouldn't have to do all the same things her first husband wanted because he's dead and the new husband doesn't require it. Now, what Paul is saying in Romans 7, verses 1 through 4, is that's how it is with us. We were, as it were, under the law of the old until the time came where we enter into a new covenant with Christ. And he's now the one who dictates what we do. We follow him, not the law of the old covenant. Now, you said that the Ten Commandments are a major part of Christianity or the church. They're actually not. The Ten Commandments as a block of legislation was given as part of the Old Covenant. And some of the things in it, at least one of them, was associated only with the Old Covenant, the matter of keeping the Sabbath. God made it very clear in Exodus that keeping the Sabbath was a special sign of that covenant that God had with the nation of Israel. Okay, well, that covenant's over. So the Sabbath, which was a sign for that covenant, has got to be on the table for renegotiation. When Jesus came up and made a new covenant, he didn't install a Sabbath day. He didn't require it, nor did he require animal sacrifices, which the old covenant required. or pilgrimages to Jerusalem, which the Old Covenant required, or the abstinence from certain meats, like the Old Covenant required. And yet there are things that Jesus and the Old Covenant both would require, just like any two husbands would expect a wife to be faithful to them. So God expects, both under the Old and the New Covenant, people to be good. He wants them to not murder or commit adultery or steal. These are criminal actions. He wants people to honor their parents and not bear false witness and not blaspheme him or have other gods before him. The fact that God under the Old Covenant expected these things of Israel, and that under the New Covenant he expects those things of Christians, is not to say that the Ten Commandments now have transferred over to us. The Ten Commandments, as a group of laws, were part of the Old Covenant, and they have passed. But under the New Covenant, God still expects faithfulness. He still expects righteousness. He still expects honesty. And therefore, of course, adultery is out of the question, because that's dishonesty. That's breaking a covenant with a wife. Murder and theft are out of the question, because those are unjust acts. In fact, Jesus said everything can be summed up in one law, and that is love. Whether it's love directed toward God or love directed toward your fellow man, the law of Christ is that we love. Now, if I love God, I won't have other gods before him. I won't blaspheme his name. I might not keep a Sabbath if he doesn't require it, because there's nothing about Sabbath keeping that intrinsically would be called for by loving God unless God said to do it. And he didn't say to do it in the New Covenant. Now, as far as honoring parents or not murdering, stealing, committing adultery, bearing false witness or coveting, these are all things that you would never do if you are a loving person. If you love your neighbors, you love yourself, you just won't do those things. Now, this is not because as Christians under the New Covenant we have to keep the old. It's because there are certain things that God expects of all people at all times that are basic standards of decency and justice and honesty. And God requires that. No, he required that before he gave the covenant Sinai. He expected it of Adam and Eve. He expected it of Noah and his generation. He expected it of Abraham and his successors. And he expected it of the Jews, and it got codified into their law at Sinai. And now that that law is over, the same standards of righteousness and justice are expected of people who follow Christ, and Christ taught them. But he didn't teach anything about keeping the Ten Commandments. He didn't give his disciples Ten Commandments. He gave them the Sermon on the Mount. He gave them those kinds of teachings. And actually, what he required was somewhat more stringent than the Ten Commandments in some respects. As we know, the Ten Commandments said you can't murder, but Jesus said you can't even hate your brother or be angry at him without a cause. The Ten Commandments said you can't commit adultery, but Jesus said you can't even desire to commit adultery with your neighbor's wife in your heart, because that's adultery too. So it's not as if Jesus suddenly came along, trashed the Ten Commandments, and made all the righteousness of the law irrelevant. Rather, he said your righteousness has to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. He actually promoted a much more thoroughgoing kind of righteousness, which, of course, overlapped righteousness before the law of Moses and after the law of Moses and in the law of Moses. Righteousness is always going to involve certain behaviors, because it's never right to commit adultery. It's never right to steal. Therefore, it wasn't right before God gave the law. It wasn't right after the law came, passed away. And it wasn't right during the time of the law. So we find in the law of Moses a covenant that God made with Israel. The Ten Commandments are part of that covenant. There's about 613 laws that were part of that covenant. The Ten Commandments are only 10 major ones, but there were a lot of lesser ones too. But the point here is that those laws contained some things that were unique to the first husband and some things that any husband would expect, as it were. Just like a woman's first husband may expect her to be faithful to him and not to spend all day on the telephone. So the second husband might wish for his wife to be faithful to him and not spend all day on the telephone, though in other respects they might be very different in what they expect of their wife. So likewise, this is a new marriage, and there are overlapping interests between God's concerns of the old and the new covenant. But the vast majority of things in the old covenant have passed away. Most of them have to do with animal sacrifices and holy days and holy places and holy foods and holy people and things like that, priests, most of those have passed away, and they're not part of the new covenant. And so that's the way I think we're supposed to be looking at this whole these categories. All right, John, I appreciate your call. Let's talk next to Ron from Los Angeles. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon.
Hey.
You know, the only problem with what you just said was that's not what God said in the Hebrew Scriptures.
Well, we go by the New Testament Scriptures. We go by the Scriptures Jesus taught. We go by the teachings of Jesus and the apostles.
You can't do that.
Well, I can. I can because I'm a Christian. Yeah, I'm a Christian, so I go by what Jesus said.
But if God says, so then God must be lying then, because God says in the Hebrew Scriptures that those laws and those are forever.
Well, do you know what the word forever means in Hebrew?
It means forever. Please.
I'm sorry, you don't know what the word means. The word in the Hebrew is olam, okay? Look it up. Wherever you find the word forever in the Old Testament, it's the Hebrew word olam. If you tell me I'm wrong, then you haven't done your research. If you look up the word olam, you see it doesn't mean forever. It is often translated that way. But the lexicons will tell you the word olam comes from the word hidden. And it really refers to that which is hidden from our view, what is beyond the horizon, what we can't see from here. And therefore, by implication, it refers to something that is so long-lasting that we can't see the end of it from here. However, many of the things that are olam were not eternal and were not what we'd call forever. For example, slavery. The man who served his master for 7 years, according to Hebrew Scriptures, was to be offered his freedom after 7 years. If he didn't want his freedom, he could get his ear pierced and then he'd serve his master forever. Really? What, off into eternity, millions of years from now? No, of course not. It just means for the duration, as long as he could see in the future. His master might release him, but that's not foreseeable. Likewise, the gates of Jerusalem are called everlasting or forever, olamic gates. Well, they're not really. And the hills are called olamic too. Hills are not forever either, for that matter. There's going to be a new heaven, new earth. So the word forever, you really have to look in context with what it's talking about. If something is said to be olam, it means it's very long-lasting for sure. In some cases, it may be something that has no end, like God himself. But you see, the covenant that God made with Israel was said to be forever. But the New Testament says it's passed away because there's a new covenant. So we have to decide, are we going to go by what you say about the Old Testament or what the New Testament says about it? That'd be the question. Well, I see you don't want to answer me on that. Okay. You're welcome to call back, and we can talk about this again, but you're going to have your facts straight, okay? Because I don't want my listeners to be deceived by people who are trying to put us under the law who don't have their facts straight. All right, we're going to talk next to Fifi from Los Angeles area, and we have a line open for you since our previous caller is gone. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Fifi, welcome to The Narrow Path. Hi.
I got it. Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Yes. Just happy to, you know, be alive.
Good.
And hello to everyone on the station. I heard you talking to the gentleman about the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. And I did understand quite well what you were saying. But I just want to ask you a question. On to that same subject. Are we all under grace and mercy?
Are we all under grace and mercy? You mean all us Christians or all people?
Yes,
or what do you mean?
Actually, Christian is not the word because there's no way in the Bible that Christ called us Christians. He called us his ambassadors, his peculiar children.
Actually, let me just correct you there. Jesus never called us by either of those terms. You're right.
Yeah, he never called us ambassadors.
No, he did not. Paul did. No, Paul used the term ambassadors. Jesus didn't. But no, Jesus never called his followers Christians. You're right about that. But he didn't call them his peculiar children or his ambassadors either. What Jesus did do, he used the word disciples. And in Acts 11:26, the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. And therefore,
Acts 11, if you look at Acts 11 itself, you see when they were called Christians in Antioch, and it was made fun of. The people in Antioch was making fun of the people that followed Christ.
Well, it doesn't say
that.
We
were called disciples, not Christians, because we're bigger than Christians.
Yeah, well, let me say this. Okay, we're going to have to talk one at a time. And I'm also going to have to take a 30-second break coming up here. I'm going to keep you on hold so that we can continue this conversation after the break. But I just want to clarify that the narrow path is on for an hour every afternoon, but some stations take only the first half hour. So we have to take a break at the end of the first half hour and say goodbye to the people who are leaving our network at this time. And just let them know, The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate, if you wish to, from the Narrow Path website. That's thenarrowpath.com. But you don't have to donate. You can just take whatever's at the website for free. Everything there is free. So just go to thenarrowpath.com, and if you want to donate, you can do it from there as well. Hope you have a wonderful new year, and we'll be talking to you again in the coming year. Please stay tuned, for those of you who are not leaving the network. In 30 seconds, we'll be back, and we'll continue our conversation.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
All right, and we are back. And before the break, we were talking to Fifi from Los Angeles. Now, Fifi, we got into a little tangle about whether we should use the word Christians for us, and you apparently don't approve of the word Christians. I have no problem with the word Christian, but I do realize that the word has come to mean many different things that it did not originally mean. And maybe that's why you're objecting to it. As far as the use of the word Christian, it is a biblical term. And the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. Now, you told me that this was a derisive term that the non-Christians used to make fun of the Christians. I've heard this view, and there are people who think it is true, and it may be correct. But the Bible certainly doesn't tell us that. It just says the Christians, or the disciples, were first called Christians at Antioch. And Paul used the term Christian, and Peter used it too, later on in the New Testament. So it doesn't sound like they objected to it. In fact, the whole faith of Christ and later generations came to take on the whole name Christian and Christianity. So I don't, whether it was originally derisive, like the song Yankee Doodle Dandy, was a derisive tune that the South made up against the Yanks, yet people in the North adopted it and said, okay, we're Yankees. The early disciples did not mind being called Christians, and I don't mind being called a Christian, though I do admit that the term has some nebulousness about it in its present usage. But let's get past that. You asked me, are we all under mercy and grace? And I asked you, you mean Christians or all people? And then you objected to me using the word Christian. So let me rephrase that. You mean disciples of Jesus, or do you mean all people?
Disciples. Are disciples under grace and mercy? All disciples under grace and mercy, or what?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. I mean, that's what makes you a disciple of Christ, is you've come to receive the grace of Christ, the grace of God in Christ.
Okay. Can I answer that question for you?
I just answered it.
No, but it's not clear enough. But can I just...
Okay, if you can say it more clearly, do, but please do it quickly. Then.
We all are under grace and mercy, but when we fall short of the glory of God, we're no longer under the grace and mercy. We become under the law. Because why? You just committed an adultery. You just committed fornication. You just committed a sin. So therefore, you're not still hanging on the grace. You're now on the laws. You have brought yourself under the laws, and you're no longer under mercy and grace. So
well, then, okay.
You commit,
so what you're saying?
You commit,
excuse me. Then what you're saying is, when a Christian commits adultery, which they should never do, of course, that they're no longer under grace, but under the law. And I suppose that means you believe they should be put to death because that's what the law says. So
no,
do you believe
that?
Well, that's what the law says. If they're under the law,
there could be mercy from the. There could be, let's say, if a person murders someone and they go to court.
Yeah.
You now honor the grace again. You honor mercy. You may be put to death, or you may be put, give life imprisonment.
Okay, well then, let me ask you then, because I'm not getting your point. You said you're going to make my point more clearly. I just said all people who are disciples of Jesus have received the grace of God in Christ. You said that wasn't clear enough or simple enough, so you're going to make it simpler, but I think you're making it more complex. Could you, in a very brief statement, tell me what you're calling about?
Cannot hear you.
Can you tell me what you're calling about? Yes. What is your
question?
I'm calling
to ask you a question. Are we all, as disciples, under grace and mercy?
Okay, well, I heard that question, and I answered it. So, yes, the answer is yes, we are. Now, there are people who cease to be disciples and are no longer under that grace and mercy because Paul told the Galatians, because they, in fact, were turning back to the law of Moses, he said they have fallen from grace and that they're estranged from Christ. But you see, a person who's estranged from Christ is not a disciple of Jesus anymore. Jesus said, if you continue in my words, then you are my disciples indeed, in John 8:31. So what makes a person a disciple is that they are continuing to be a follower of Christ. Someone who's become estranged from Christ is not a disciple anymore. And Paul said that they have fallen from grace. So you and I have a little difference of opinion there. I think you believe that every time a person sins, they fall from grace and they're under the law. But you're not very consistent because I asked you if a Christian committed adultery and you say then they're under the law, should they be put to death? And you said no, but the law says they should. So it doesn't sound like you really believe they're under the law. You just, I don't think your point was anywhere near as clear as you thought it was. And I don't quite know where you stand on these issues, but I'm going to have to move along to other callers because you said the same thing twice, asked the same question twice, and we've got some people waiting who haven't asked their question even once. Rod from Philadelphia, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. I have a question. I hope I can phrase it right. It sounds kind of weird, but you probably understand what I'm saying. For me, there's a slightly problematic theme in Genesis. It's real simple, but I just don't really understand. And it's regarding whether the serpent in the garden is to be taken literalistically or literally. And in other words, is he real or symbolic of Satan? And I'm talking about Genesis 3, the serpent. And the reason why I say that is because at the beginning, he was described as being more cunning than any beast of the field. So he's being given a human characteristic. And then he goes on to deceive Eve and is subsequently punished. So then when you look at his punishment in verse 14, as a result, he was cursed by basically having his arms and legs removed, and then he's crawling on and eating the dust. And then also enmity is put between his seed and the seed of Eve. So I guess my point is, what if he's to be taken literally as a literal talking snake, then what is the eternal significance of punishing an animal? And then if it's not the serpent's fault that Eve was deceived, then why does the author even bother to mention in the beginning of chapter 3 the intellectual capacity of the serpent? So that's kind of my first question.
Okay. Well, first of all, I do believe that the account is essentially literal. I know some conservative evangelicals who don't think we're supposed to take it literally. They think we're supposed to take it figuratively. Now, some might say, well, that's not very conservative. They should take it literally if they're conservative. And I believe it can be taken literally, and I don't have any problem doing so. However, it's not unconservative or liberal to recognize that some parts of the scripture are written to be taken in a non-literal sense. So the visions of Daniel, for example, nobody takes them literally. There's beasts coming out of the sea, and they represent things, kingdoms, and so forth. There are parts of the Bible that are told to us in symbolic form or in parables or things like that, which, of course, in order to understand them correctly, we'd have to understand the means by which we're intended to understand them. And some people think that the first three chapters of Genesis are chapters that we are intended to take symbolically or, as a parable or something like that, rather than a literal story. Now, this is not necessarily liberalism. This is just a difference of opinion as to whether this is intended to be taken literally or not. I think it is, and that's my call, my judgment call. I could be wrong about that. Someday maybe I'll find out I was wrong if I go to heaven and ask about that. Maybe they'll say, you were taking that literally? That was supposed to be understood symbolically. Well, maybe so. I don't think I'm damaged by taking it literally. And I'm not sure a person is damaged by taking it symbolically, honestly. I mean, as long as they follow Jesus and believe in him, I think that they could see some of those chapters as being symbolic. Now, for example, while I do believe there was a literal talking snake, Hank Hanegraaff, the Bible Answer Man, does not. He thinks that's symbolic. Now, he's conservative Christian theologian. He just has a different view of that. We've discussed it and disagreed with each other on it. But it's not an issue that divides us because it's just not that kind of an issue. Now, you asked about why the serpent, if it's a literal animal, would be punished for its role, and why was it said to be more cunning than all the other animals? We're not given answers to that, so I'm going to have to give you my best guess. I believe that the serpent probably became possessed by the devil, and that's what gave it its rational powers at that moment. Animals can become demon-possessed. We know that from the New Testament. Jesus even cast demons into a herd of pigs. Apparently the pigs all became possessed. They didn't become rational, though. They became irrational and jumped into a lake, but that's kind of, demons are kind of irrational sometimes. But Satan can inhabit an animal, apparently, and that's what appears to be the case. He is identified in Revelation 12:9 as that ancient serpent who's called Satan and the devil, it says in Revelation 12:9. So Satan is identified with the serpent in the book of Revelation. But in Genesis, it just talks about the serpent. We recognize from later Revelation that the devil was the mouth of that serpent, or the devil's, the serpent was the mouthpiece of the devil. But why then would the serpent be punished? Why would that species have to go on their belly? Well, in my opinion, it would not be because God really holds the snake responsible, but he's making an example of the snake for all humanity to remember, the way that the serpent was used in human history, and the role that it played in the fall. You know, in the Old Testament, God sometimes imposed inconveniences on certain persons, for example, who were guilty of nothing. A person could be unclean in the Jewish law because they had leprosy, or because a woman had her period, or because a woman had a baby, or other things that are not bad things, that is, they're not sinful things. And a woman was not being punished for having a baby or having her period, or a person punished for having leprosy, but they still had to play out a role that signified something in the symbolic drama of the law, where uncleanness, I think, was a type and a picture of sin. And although the people who were lepers were not particularly more sinful than anyone else, their leprosy provided a circumstance for God to make some statements about sin, using leprosy as a symbol of it. The leper himself was an innocent bystander who happened to get leprosy, but since he had it, it was, the role he played of being unclean and so forth was used as a teaching device. I think the serpent was an innocent creature that was, exploited by the devil. But the serpent has had to go on its belly ever since as a reminder, as something that kind of just reminds us that the serpent had this particular role in the fall. And that's why I think it happened. I mean, like I said, I'm guessing. And there are Christians who think the whole thing is merely symbolic and that it didn't happen at all quite that way. But I believe it did. I have no trouble believing that it did. And so that would be my opinion about that. I hope that is helpful to you. Nori from Fallbrook, California, is our next caller. Hi, Nori. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Thanks for waiting online so long.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's great to talk to you again. I had a question about, I was reading in Acts how they had done the Jerusalem Council and they decided on three things that were important. And then later it says that Paul was somewhere with Timothy and he took him and got him circumcised. And I thought, well, why would he do that after they just said that wasn't one of the things that was important? And then and also seeing that Paul was sent to the Gentiles, why would he circumcise Timothy when he wasn't even sent to the Jews? Did he make a mistake on that? And I'll take your answer offline.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Nori. Oops, I'm sorry. I cut you off there. I thought we were done. Did Paul make a mistake? I don't think so. I think Paul was acting consistently with his policy of ministry, how that he said to those under the law, I become as one who's under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without the law, he means Gentiles, I live as one without the law, as I live like a Gentile, that I might win those who are without the law. So Paul would adjust himself culturally to different sensitivities in order to not put a stumbling block or prevent them from receiving the gospel as he preached it. Now, the Jerusalem Council was convened to decide whether Gentile Christians needed to be circumcised and join the Jewish religion or not. And the decision of the Jerusalem Council, of course, was that they did not. They did not have to be circumcised. And Paul was the champion of that view, so he was vindicated at that council. But before you know it, he's out on his second missionary journey, calling Timothy, a young man of Lystra, who had been converted during Paul's first missionary journey before the Jerusalem Council. Timothy, probably in his late teens, is called to follow Paul as an apprentice in the ministry. And at the very outset, it says that Paul had him circumcised. That's in Acts chapter 16, the very chapter after the Jerusalem Council. So why did he have him circumcised? It says Timothy had a Jewish mother, but his father was a Greek. It says that in Acts 16:1. Now, because he had a Jewish mother, he was technically Jewish. But because his father was a Greek and the head of the household, he had not had his son circumcised. So although Timothy was technically Jewish, he was really only half Jewish, but because his mother was Jewish, the Jews would regard him as a Jew. But his father had not had him circumcised as a baby. Paul knew that as he traveled with Timothy, that the Jews would recognize Timothy as a Jew because of his Jewish mother. And they would be concerned to know, well, is he circumcised? And if Paul would say no, then it would only give the impression that Paul was forbidding Jews to be circumcised. Now, later on, when Paul came to James in Jerusalem, James said, there's reports about you that you're forbidding the Jews to circumcise their children. And I know you don't teach that. And so you can prove that you don't. I want you to go do such and such. And Paul did it to prove that he doesn't teach that the Jews were forbidden to circumcise their children. Paul didn't care whether Jews culturally kept the circumcision ritual or not, but he rejected the idea that Gentiles needed to be circumcised. But Timothy was on the borderline. He was part Gentile and part Jew, and the part of him that was Jew could very well have been definitive of whether he's Jew or Gentile. And if he was regarded as a Jewish boy and he was not circumcised, this could definitely raise controversies in Paul's ministry that he didn't intend to raise. Now, he didn't mind controversy over an issue that mattered to him. For example, in Galatians 2, Paul says that when Titus, who was a Gentile, came to Jerusalem with him, Paul would not allow the pressure of the Jews to cause him to be circumcised. He said, I wouldn't let them circumcise Timothy. They wanted to, but I didn't let them. He's a Gentile. And Paul's adamance was on the idea that Gentiles are not under the law. They don't have to be circumcised. I don't think Paul believed that Jews had to be circumcised in the faith of Christ, but he didn't object to them doing it. Most of them were circumcised as children anyway before they were converted, so he couldn't do anything about it. The point was that Paul didn't come along to tell Jews whether or not they should circumcise. He came to tell them they can't insist on Gentiles being circumcised because Gentiles, when they become Christians, are not becoming Jewish proselytes. And circumcision would suggest that they are. That was the point that Paul would not yield for a moment on, he said in Galatians chapter 2. So we have him not circumcising Titus, who is a Gentile, but he does circumcise Timothy because Timothy is a Jew. And it says in verse 1 of Acts chapter 16, verse 3, Paul wanted to have Timothy go with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were of that region. For they all knew that his father was a Greek. In other words, you couldn't tell when you saw a man walking down the street if he was circumcised or not. That's usually part of the body that's not exposed in public. But they might ask. They knew he had a Jewish mother, and they knew his father was a Greek, which means that might make them suspect, since he had a Greek father, that maybe he wasn't circumcised, and that maybe Paul was traveling with a Jewish boy who was not circumcised, and therefore Paul was undermining circumcision among the Jews. Paul knew that all of those things would be going through the heads of the Jews, and so it says because of the Jews in that region, he had him circumcised. And this agrees totally with Paul's general policy of, when he's trying to reach Jews, he doesn't want to put unnecessary stumbling blocks in their way. And therefore, having an uncircumcised Jewish companion in the ministry would be extremely controversial. And Paul didn't want that particular kind of distraction from his ministry happening. So he just said, listen, you're Jewish. Go ahead and get circumcised, and that'll take care of that. Then if anyone asks, we'd say, yeah, he's circumcised. Leave him alone, you know. Whereas with Titus, if they asked, Paul would say, no, Titus isn't circumcised. Why should he be? He's a Gentile. So this is why Paul did what he did with Timothy, but not with Titus. All right, let's talk to Nicole from Sacramento, California. Nicole, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I heard the woman who had said that Christians weren't called Christians, and I can also attest to that as I'm doing studies from Blue Letter Bible, and I just read yesterday a few sources on Blue Letter Bible on the history course of how the Christians were called when Paul, I believe it's Paul, who says, don't be ashamed to be called, you know, the name Christian.
That's Peter in 1 Peter 4:16.
Is it Peter? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Peter, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting because don't be ashamed of that name, right? Meaning of Christ or being of Christ. And,
well, he says, if any man suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed.
Yeah, as a Christian. Yeah. So what it was saying was that it was, there's strong evidence, of course none of us were there, but there's very strong evidence to assume that they were called Christians as a derogatory term to say, there, look, that's one of the Christians, one of those who are of Christ, you know.
Well, the word Christian, the word Christian is only used three times in the New Testament, which means only three times in the whole Bible. It is used initially when it is first introduced in Acts 11:26. The disciples, it says, were first called Christians in Antioch. It doesn't say what the motive was of calling them Christians. It doesn't say whether it was their enemies or their friends or they themselves that called them Christians. It just says they were first called Christians in Antioch. It's very commonly taught that this was a term assigned to them by the unbelievers as a derisive term. It is taught, but it's not stated in Scripture. It's taught popularly by preachers and teachers, and apparently by the Blue Letter course that you're it does perhaps suggest that, but the Bible doesn't say it was so. Now, the only other two times that the word Christian appears is in the book of Acts, where Paul is talking to Agrippa and giving his testimony. Agrippa says, Paul, almost you persuade me to become a Christian. Now, when Agrippa used the word Christian, he might have meant it derisively because he was not a Christian. But a person could use it derisively if they hated Christians and use it not derisively if they were Christians, as is the case today. Today, I can say I'm a Christian, and it's not a term of derision. If Richard Dawkins uses the word Christian, it's a term of derision to him. But he didn't form the word. He's simply using a word that has come to be associated with Christians, and he doesn't like Christians. So he'd use that word derisively. Likewise, the third time and last time that the word Christian appears in the New Testament is in 1 Peter 4:16, as I mentioned. And Peter there is talking about being persecuted and suffering. And he says, if you suffer for being an evildoer, well, there's no glory in that. But if you suffer for being a Christian, don't be ashamed of that. Now, notice he didn't say, if you suffer by being called a Christian, don't be ashamed. Maybe he means that. But he's saying, if you suffer for doing the wrong things, for being a criminal, the way he puts it, he says, let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a busybody in other people's matters. Okay, but he says, but if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. He's saying, if you're going to suffer, let it be because you are a Christian. In other words, because you're a follower of Christ. He doesn't say that being called a Christian is a form of suffering because, I mean, Peter obviously is applying the term to his readers as Christians here. We don't have any evidence that the Christians objected to the term Christian being used of them. After all, the word Christian means belonging to Christ, just like a Herodian belongs to Herod. You know, that we belong to Christ is not negative.
Of course not. I just thought that was interesting, and also I noticed we call ourselves Christians. Everybody, you know, we're called Christians, but if maybe we were to think of ourselves or call ourselves, or if we were referred to as disciples from clergy or pastors, what have you, that it might help us to see it in a different light, because what a disciple is, one might think, could possibly be different than a Christian. Although I've come to the conclusion that you can't be a Christian without being a disciple.
Yeah, yeah. The terms are interchangeable terms in the Bible, but
other
I agree with
might
you.
Say not, but
what's that?
I said I've had debate with people who have thought you can be a Christian without being a disciple, but from reading the scriptures, I've come to the conclusion that
exactly.
The
I mean,
two
if we're going
interchangeable, you know.
Yeah, if we're going to use the term the way it's used in the Bible, it says the disciples were called Christians, so. Christian and disciple are interchangeable terms that apply to the same people. But I agree with you that the word Christian has become almost useless in modern times. It's you know, Christianity is considered one of the great religions of the world. And, you know, 1.5 billion people call themselves Christians, of whom only a tiny, tiny fraction, certainly, are true disciples of Jesus. So that the word disciple describes, you know, what a real Christian is. The word Christian doesn't necessarily convey what a real Christian is anymore. Because if you're baptized into the Catholic Church or the Presbyterian Church or the Episcopalian Church, you're called a Christian, whether you believe in Christ or not.
Exactly. And when they speak about it in the mass media, they group all of the so-called Christians into one. And many of those I don't consider to be Christians, such as Jehovah's
right.
Witnesses, Catholics. I personally don't consider worshiping. I consider worshiping Mary and saints to be idolatry. I don't consider it Christians. But when they talk about Christians who put many to death in centuries past, I think it could be deceiving.
Right. When they talk about how Christians have put people to death in the past, that what they mean, of course, is the institutional church has done that. Yeah. They're using the word Christian, as I said, in a way that has been deprived of all its original meaning. And I agree with you that the word Christian is not a fortunate term to have to go by now. And to use the word disciple would be fine. I like the word disciple very much. I don't always use it because people don't always know what it means, but I don't mind telling them if we have time. But I also don't mind the word Christian if people understand I'm using it in the biblical sense of a disciple of Jesus. I also realize many people don't use it that way. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are a listener-supported ministry. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can donate from our website where everything can be had for free at thenarrowpath.com. Have a happy new year, and we'll talk to you next year.